Yeah, this is my first time in Ottawa. I was real pleased to see snow on the ground because right before Christmas time, coming up from the United States to Canada, you expect it to look real cold and snowy. And I was in Toronto yesterday, and it was in the 60s, and it was a beautiful day, but kind of disappointing when you're expecting. Well, yeah, actually, that's very nice. It's kind of what you, it's within the range of what you hope to see or what you expect, but not. I went to Winnipeg one time in February, and that was the extreme. And I had visions of that. I almost, we tried to arrange this. We've been trying to arrange this since the summer, and we had it in October, but then we couldn't get a date in October and moved to November. Then I moved to December, and I was getting a little concerned about coming to Canada in December, but this is perfect. Yeah, I'm from the University of Missouri, Rolla. I've been there, well, I guess, yeah. Gary already said that. I've been there 8 years. Before that, I was at IBM. Quite often, I'll have people call me up and say, gee, our upper-level management just realized that EMC's problems are costing this company a lot of money, and so there's a big push to attack the EMC problem. And so we've got all this money available to buy some software to help us solve our problems. What software would you recommend? And, well, generally I'll say, well, what do you want to do with the software? And in general, people have no idea. They just need software to help them with EMC. And then generally my response is, if you don't know what you want it for, there's no software that can help you. Software that we've never seen numerical modeling software being used by EMC labs. It's always sitting on the shelf, and it's always there because some salesman who really didn't know what his software was capable of doing talked to some manager who really didn't know what they needed done, and they decided that for $50,000 they were going to save the company millions of dollars in productivity of some kind, and it just doesn't work that way. At our laboratory at UMR, we've got several numerical modeling tools, all kinds, and we've got several of the commercial codes listed there. We've also got codes that we've written ourselves. We use them quite a bit. We also have lots of products that come into our lab with EMC problems for analysis testing, essentially fixing, although we don't work on the same kind of schedule that you work on. We don't take products in our lab that have to be shipped in 3 weeks. But we will take products into our lab and analyze them, find out what kinds of EMC problems they had, and report that back to the company so that on our next product they won't make that same mistake. But never once, even though we've got all these numerical modeling tools, never once have we ever used numerical modeling tools to fix an EMC problem or to find an EMC problem. Generally, to use a numerical modeling tool, you have to know what's the source of the problem, what are the things that are the antennas, what aspects of the design are causing the radiation. If you already know that stuff well enough to numerically model it, you can probably fix it without actually doing the numerical modeling. So numerical modeling tools, I think they're an invaluable tool for EMC engineers, but they're not a tool that's going to help an EMC engineer fix a product. Unfortunately, it's not the EMC engineers who are often buying these things, and a lot of software companies have got the idea if they can attach EMC to their name of their product or advertise their product in the EMC trade journals, that their market goes from a very small group of people, which would be the EM people who can do numerical modeling, to a very big group of people, which is the people who have EMC problems. And so a lot of products get marketed as EMC modeling software. Actually, the list up there, I made this transparency up almost 2 years ago. A lot of these companies have gone out of business. Some of them have merged. There are some new names that should go up there. But there's a wide variety of software that gets marketed to EMC engineers. So what we're going to try to do today is sort through that for a given application, what type of modeling software makes sense for that application. There are four categories of software that gets marketed to EMC engineers. Numerical modeling software, that's what everybody thinks of. This is generally the expensive software. Numerical modeling software is software that's solving Maxwell's equations subject to boundary conditions that you impose. It's solving Maxwell's equations in their general form. So FDTD codes, finite element codes, moment method codes, those are numerical modeling software. Analytical modeling software is software that is not solving Maxwell's equations. It runs on the computer, but it's solving generally some closed form equations, simplified equations. It's usually very specific. You can get analytical modeling software that predicts crosstalk between cables in a conductor, maybe in a shielded conductor, for different size and shape for different cable cross sections. And it doesn't have to solve Maxwell's equations every time because it's a well-defined enough geometry that there are closed-form solutions it can use. So analytical modeling software in general will run very quickly. It's very relatively easy to use, but it's very limited in scope. It's for one specific thing. There are tools out there, software out there that I would call analytical modeling software that does do things like predict radiated EMI from printed circuit boards. They use closed form equations, but the tools that do that are not modeling the right thing and so not very useful. I wouldn't say all analytical modeling software is not useful. Some of it's very useful, some of it is not. Design rule checkers look for basic problems in a circuit design. They don't try to do any electromagnetic modeling at all. They just look at a board layout, and they look for things that are mistakes in the board layout and report those mistakes back to the person who ran the code. We worked with Boeing a while back, and Boeing had gone through an experience similar to what I described before, where management realized they had some EMC. EMC was causing them to lay out boards four or five times, and that was slowing down their schedule. It got upper level management's attention. They said, we have to do something about EMC. And so they were out talking with software vendors. They ended up buying a numerical modeling tool, a very expensive tool. They bought a license that would allow every engineer in the whole corporation to use it. And they sent every design engineer in the whole corporation, every electrical engineer, to a two-week course to learn how to use this numerical modeling software. We got involved with them about a year later, and that's about the time they realized, hey, our boards are not any better now than they were back then. And one of the things that we were doing was talking to the engineers then about what they were doing with the software. And as it turns out, very few of them were using it at all because numerical modeling software is hard to learn to use. And you have to know what you're doing. It's hard enough if you have an electrical engineering background and you remember all of your electromagnetics and you know what you want to model. But if you don't remember your electromagnetic, you don't remember what Maxwell's equations were, to try to use numerical modeling software is extremely difficult. To use it in a good way, you can always run it. Numerical modeling software, no matter what you give it, it generally gives you a result. But to get good results that are meaningful and helpful requires a great deal of expertise. So very few people were using it. And those that were using it, the numerical modeling software wasn't telling them, oh, you're making these mistakes in the board. And so many of the board designs that we were looking at had just gross errors, things that anybody who had taken an EMC course would have realized, you know, this shouldn't be done this way. They had high-speed traces running across the board over gaps in the ground plane. They had their ground plane all gapped up. Well, there were a lot of things that were relatively obvious. Yeah, decoupling capacitors connected through very long traces. So they snake out the trace and pick up power over here and ground over here. They were just basic mistakes. At that point, this was before there were any commercial design rule checkers, and one of the things that we did for Boeing was to write a design rule checker for Boeing. And what we did is wrote software that recognized the components that Boeing used on their boards, the components and circuits that they used, and looked for specific, I think there was eight or nine specific design rule violations that it looked for. And just if it found a design rule violation, it said, okay, this is a mistake, you shouldn't do this. And gave one sentence of advice as to what should be done instead. Soon after that, actually at the same conference that we presented the paper with the Boeing Design Rule Checker, there was a commercial design rule checking code being shown in the exhibit hall, and we went over to look at that. It's a great idea, but it hasn't really caught on. And the reason it hasn't caught on is because to sell one commercially to anybody, you don't have a knowledge a priori of what all the components on the board are. And so you don't really know from the board layout files what the signals look like on any of the traces. And you can't make an intelligent, you know, did you violate a design rule decision unless you know what kinds of signals were on each kind of, on each trace on the board. So the only way to get that information is to ask the user, okay, tell me what's on this trace, frequency, rise time. It's if you have a board with 100 nets or 1,000 nets on it, by the time the user has put in all of the numbers for the 100 nets, well, they've given up way before they get to that point. If they only go to the critical nets and put in those numbers, that works. But if you knew what all the critical nets were, you had enough expertise to probably know what you should have done. And for that reason, the commercial design rule checkers just haven't taken off. No, right. Not yet. Well, I haven't talked about expert system software. No, even with expert system software, you're not out of a job. Expert system software is designed to look at boards like a design rule checker, although instead of checking for design rule violations, expert system software looks across the board to identify structures that are like or circuits that are likely to be sources and structures that are likely to be antennas and coupling paths. And every time it finds a source antenna, it looks for the coupling path. And when it finds a source coupling path antenna combination, it can evaluate that and put a number behind it. And it can do that, iterate through the entire board, and in the end, come up with an estimate for how that board is likely to radiate or what aspects of that board are likely to make it susceptible, not based on design rules, but based on calculations, closed form type calculations. It's approximate, but it's working the way a human would work if a human were looking at that board. A human analyzing a board isn't going to rip out numerical modeling software and do a full wave calculation. They're going to look for things that they recognize are potential problems and then either from experience or with a simple calculation determine how much of a problem that is.
Is a simple calculation also something that fits into the design rule? You know, you can describe the design rule with the equation. That's what you do actually. You know, in a project, you have a simple equation to handle.
Yeah.
Follow 100% now what you think is the difference between checking against the rule automatically with a design rule. If, you know, for example, you can check for, let's say, you specify a limit of propagation like the transition line over the right time you allocate to that driver.
Yeah, you could specify a design rule that way and then see, did I exceed that design rule? Right. 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 That would be a design rule. What the expert system would do, even if you had a fast rise time on a long trace, it would look for an antenna. I mean, is the trace the antenna? Actually, unlikely. But and then calculate essentially radiated EMI. To me, that's going up into the realm of analytical modeling software because circuits don't really radiate that way. And it's a closed form calculation that you can do, but that doesn't mean it's the one you should do.
Just take an example that, you know, that the policy you mentioned, it can be important. You have kind of a simple closed form calculation that describes the problem and you specify that between the world.
I get the sort of the idea behind an expert system, although that's not much of an expert if that's what they're doing, because on real printed circuit boards, real ones meaning boards you're actually likely to see brought to you as an EMC engineer, you'd virtually never see a situation where you had radiation directly off a trace that was significant. What's going to happen below 500 megahertz? Traces are just going to be too small to be good antennas. Something else is going to be a good antenna. Above 500 megahertz, that system is probably going to be in metal enclosures. And what's going to happen is that trace, if it can be a source, is going to drive that enclosure. And at some frequencies, that enclosure will be resonant and will radiate out the apertures. And that will be the mechanism for the radiation. But we can't then use a closed form solution for our trace radiating in free space. The number of boards we see that are operating at real high frequencies hanging out in the air is zero. People don't try to do that. And for good reason. If you put a very good antenna out in free space, you're going to exceed the whatever requirements you're trying to meet. But I think back to the original idea, the expert system we'll try to do calculations that make sense and predict radiated EMI, whereas the design rule checker, will say the leads on this decoupling capacitor are too long.
Rules of thumb.
Yeah, that's right.
But you need to see the core plan before you've even built anything.
Right.
Don't do this.
Whereas an expert system might do the design rule check, but it wouldn't use that in the estimate. The expert system would estimate the power bus noise and then estimate the effect of that decoupling capacitor on the power bus noise. And if the traces were too long, it would have no effect, and it would all fall into the calculation. So we would never have to go back and say and look for some minimum or maximum length on a trace for a decoupling cap. It would fall out in the calculations. So it's quite a difference. An expert system software is actually quite a bit more sophisticated than a design rule checker. But a design rule checker, if we could get all the trace information in there easily, would be a nice quick way to find a lot of, because we still see lots of boards, even that come into our lab, designed by companies with good EMC departments that still come in and have basic design rule violations. It's just that maybe they're not so easy to see. Maybe it's a 14-layer board, and somewhere on layer 8, they ran a clock trace up next to an I/O trace, if you were talking about. That can happen, and it can be very hard for a human EMC engineer to find a mistake like that. And a design rule checker can find that right away.
You can take the top 10 that screw up, and any product that fails, at least 8 of those screw ups are incorporated.
To get a unique solution, we have to supply a complete set of boundary conditions. So we can't describe half of the design but not describe, say, the enclosure or something. We have to describe everything. And we're going to get one solution. Hopefully, it's the right solution. But there can be only one unique solution when we have a complete set of boundary conditions. So our geometries have to be very well defined. You can't say my source is an HC10. You've got to say my source is a delta gap voltage source with one volt or whatever. You have to specify the voltage, source, impedance. It has to be very clear exactly what your source is, what all your coupling paths or potential coupling paths are, what potentially your antennas are. All of that has to be in the geometry. Different techniques. Numerical modeling software uses different techniques to solve Maxwell's equations. Finite difference time domain, transmission line matrix, finite element method, moment method, boundary element method. You've heard all those terms. I'm going to talk about each of those techniques because knowing what kind of technique a particular software package uses tells you an awful lot about what it's going to be capable of modeling and what it's not going to be capable of modeling.
Modeling those kind of numerical, or using those kind of numerical codes for modeling your PCB.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be also interested. So I really have a lot of doubt that it's going to be possible in the future to do that.
Yeah.
I see a potential in maybe more for enclosures.
Yeah. Okay. Actually, I would agree with you completely in that the first thing you said, we're never going to be able to use numerical modeling software to analyze a printed circuit board. That'll never happen. Even if we had infinite computer power, infinitely fast computers with infinite storage, we could not do it because we cannot input enough information to have a complete set of boundary conditions. The only way we could really analyze that printed circuit board numerically would be to know everything about it, and the person analyzing it doesn't know everything about it. And so, you're right, that's never going to happen. It's not a matter of wait till the computers get faster.
I would like to keep all the questions and comments at the end.
You're worried because I'm only on my third transparency and you see the stack? No, but this is fine because I can a lot of the points that are coming out would come out later anyway. Okay, but I will also, in terms of modeling enclosures, right? We're already there. Different techniques to model enclosures very well. Although I, just as an aside, we'll never be to the point where we can model the enclosure to determine resonant frequencies and then design our system to be, because real enclosures are too sensitive to small changes. You take out one card, you put in a different card, you change the resonant frequencies associated with the enclosure. And so trying to predict that with a numerical tool isn't practical either. But we can model the enclosures very well. Okay. You can choose the right numerical modeling software. One question that doesn't get asked nearly often enough when somebody is about to choose numerical modeling is the modeling CD solver. Those are very, very different codes, very different. And people just think, oh, we need EM modeling software. If you're going to model something very complex, even moderately complex, if you're going to model it at 100 hertz or less, and the thing is this size or smaller, you should be using a static field solver, either an electrostatic field solver, electric field solver, or a magnetic field solver. And the reason is, first of all, it's going to use vastly less computer resources for a given difficulty of the problem, given difficulty of the geometry. But it's going to run much faster, and it's going to give you a more accurate answer. You can do amazing things with static field solvers. The only thing you can't model radiation. You can't model high frequency situations. Although, even in a high frequency situation, you might have a transmission line operating at 100 megahertz. But if its cross section is a couple of millimeters, you can use a static field solver to model that transmission line, or at least many things about that transmission line. Just with a static field solver. You don't need a 3D solver. As soon as you move up from a static field solver, I shouldn't even say move up, I say move over, to a 2D solver or time domain solver, you lose an awful lot. You lose an awful lot in terms of ability to model things. The complexity of the code, the complexity of, or the amount of computer resources required to solve something takes a giant step when you move up to 2D. And also, your ability to interpret the results becomes more difficult as you move up. So if you can model something with a static field solver, that's what you should be using. The codes I've got listed up there are codes that just examples of static field solvers. Things that are in red are available for free over the internet, or QuickField has a demo code that's not exactly free anymore. The demo is free. And the things that are black are commercial codes. 2D solvers, if you're modeling a transmission line, propagation in a transmission line, waveguide, something that has either symmetry in one, in very long in one direction, or even if it has rotational symmetry, you can use a 2D solver. then you should solve this problem with a 2D solver instead of a 3D solver, because 3D solvers require a lot more computer resources, a lot more memory, take a lot longer to run, are a lot more difficult to use than 2D solvers. And a nice thing about 2D solvers is you can display your results on a 2D computer screen and see everything, whereas with a 3D solver, after you run it, it's a lot more involved in terms of just displaying what you got or interpreting what you got. There are things called 2.5D solvers. 2.5D solvers model 3D geometries, but not arbitrary 3D geometries. They assume you've got, an example of that would be like a microwave transmission line solver or microstrip line solver where, yeah, the line can go out, it can make bends, it can do 3D type things, but it's got to be a planar geometry. That's something, it's more than a strictly 2D solver, but it's not in a general 3D solver. And then 3D full wave solvers, you only use those when you can't use anything else. And if you're going to use them, it's going to require a lot of computer time. It's going to require a big investment on your part in learning to use the software. And you're not going to be able to model real complex looking things. A lot of times when people sell software, the plots they show are the plots that their static field solvers produced, very intricate geometries. And then they say, yeah, we do 3D too. And they list things, but you don't necessarily see the outputs, because the things you can do realistically in 3D are often quite a bit simpler. If you want to get, let me come back to that. I mentioned you can tell an awful lot about a code by what technique it uses. And all of these commercial codes advertise what technique they use. If you're going to get a code that advertises itself as a moment method code or a boundary element method code, moment method, boundary element method, to EM engineers, those terms are essentially synonymous. The codes are really all boundary element method codes. Method of moments is really a technique for solving integral equations, integral differential equations. But because of the history, because of the early work that was done with the method of moments in the University of Syracuse, people working in EM tend to use the word method of moments to mean boundary element method codes. I've had salesmen tell me, yeah, we use the boundary element method, they use the method of moments, and this is why, that's why our code is superior, and it's just silly. They're surface integral techniques. These techniques work by solving integral equations. Without going into the details of how a surface integral technique works, the way to recognize if you've got a code that is using a surface integral technique is that the meshing that is done will be on surfaces. If you have a 3D code, you'll have a 2D mesh. If you have a 2D code, you'll have a line mesh, a 1D mesh. You only integrate over you solve for unknowns over the boundaries of the things that you're modeling. as a result, compared to other techniques, surface integral methods end up with relatively fewer unknowns, usually, because it takes fewer unknowns to model just the surfaces than it does to mesh up the entire volume. But they're going to solve a full matrix equation. They're going to create a big system of linear equations, so they have a big matrix equation they need to solve. And the order of that matrix will be the number of unknowns. Typically, a complex problem will be on the order, if you have 1,000 unknowns, that's requiring now quite a bit of time. It's quite a big computer. It'll take a while. to run. So if you're on the order of, well, that's, yeah, 1,000 to 5,000 unknowns, that's a big problem. If you have a code that's a boundary element method code or a moment method code, the things, it doesn't show up as well as it probably should, but the things in orange are the things that it's not going to do very well. If you have very complex source geometries, moment method codes are not the best thing, because complex source geometries implies that you've got a lot of interfaces between different materials around your source. That means you've got a lot of little elements, a lot of little mesh elements around your source. Things are looking very complicated in there. That's going to create problems for a surface integral technique. Just dielectrics in general, a lot of codes that are moment method codes, if they can handle dielectrics at all, they handle dielectrics that are big and not very inhomogeneous. If you've got, or even something like a printed circuit board, if you've got a moment method code that can model the printed circuit board with the dielectric in there, that is requiring a great deal of computational effort. Whereas if you could model that same printed circuit board and take the dielectric out, all of a sudden the moment method code looks much, much better. And the reason for that is, first of all, every time you have that, if you have dielectrics, that means you've got more material interfaces. Also, on the surface of a dielectric, you actually have two unknowns for every, you have equivalent electric currents and equivalent magnetic currents that you have to worry about on the surface. On the surface of conductors, the equivalent magnetic currents are zero. You just have to worry about equivalent electric currents, which conveniently turn out to be equal to the actual electric currents on the surface of the conductor. And so moment method codes work really well for configurations of conductors. But as soon as we add dielectrics to a problem, that's a strike against a moment method code. It makes things much more difficult for a moment method code. Thin metal surfaces, if you've got a shield and you want to model, you've got a source on one side of the shield and you want to find out what's happening on the opposite side of the shield, that's a problem for a moment method code. Because moment method codes would like to model that as being infinitely thin, but numerically we that creates problems. If we have an infinitely thin shield, numerically we're counting on all of the equivalent currents that we induce on this infinitely thin shield to cancel exactly with the fields that are incident on them. And to the extent that they can't, because our mesh is not not infinitely fine, things leak through the shield. And so moment method codes do not handle that nicely. Tightly coupled electrically small conductors. If you've got a, say, a printed circuit board type configuration, you've got a trace over a ground plane here, and then that's attached to a cable, and the cable runs, say, from here to the wall. When I mesh up the conductors in the region of the printed circuit board, I'm making little things this big, and so I might have the trace there and the ground plane there, and I've got little tiny elements very close to one another. And out here where the cable is, I don't want elements that big, so the elements are maybe this big. So I've got big elements out here. Well, when I create the matrix for that, I'm going to have real high numbers associated with these conductors that are very, very close, and small numbers associated with the interaction between those tiny conductors and the conductors out here. So I end up making a matrix with very big numbers in it and very small numbers in it, and numerically that creates problems. I start to get numerical error very quickly. And so when you have situations like that, actually printed circuit board attached to a long cable, that's a very difficult thing to model with a moment method code. It can be done, but it's not the ideal way to handle that situation. Okay, so those are all the things that are not so good. But where moment method codes really shine is if you have those thin electrically long or resonant wires, it can model those very nicely. You can model a half-wave dipole with a moment method code with 10 or 20 unknowns and get a very accurate calculation of the radiated fields and the input impedance of the currents on the half-wave dipole. There's no other technique where with that few unknowns you can get that accurate of an answer. we can model long resonant wires very well. Unbounded geometries, it's a natural for unbounded meaning radiating into space. There's no problem. We kind of assume that everything's radiating into space. Actually, we can have problems if we don't. If we're inside a resonant cavity, that can create problems for a moment method code. But radiation problems are fine. So if I've got long wires, actually, where moment method codes have been used a lot is to model things like aircraft, ships, and often they'll model those things, first of all, to take all the dielectrics away. And quite often, they'll model them with wire grids. Because with a wire grid, it turns out we have far fewer unknowns if we can model something with a wire grid than we do if we model it with metal plates. But either way, moment method codes are made for things like that. If you wanted to try out a moment method code, I like to recommend the numerical electromagnetics code because it's available for free. It's very powerful. People model ships, planes, helicopters with the NEC code. It hasn't got a very glamorous interface on it, but I think that's really an advantage because you don't have to learn the interface. You can just learn to use the code. And there are commercial interfaces for the NEC code that are available really at nominal cost, you know, $100 or $200. So if you really got interested in the NEC code and wanted to use it over and over again, you might want to invest in an interface for it. But this is a way to get a feeling for what numerical modeling codes can do and how difficult they are to work with. And so it falls in the category of techniques called PDE techniques, partial differential equation techniques. If we have a PDE technique, it's going to be characterized by having to mesh up the volume. We mesh up everything. We're not solving it for unknowns on the surface. We're solving for fields throughout the entire volume. So we'll have a big grid. It won't necessarily look cubicle like that, but we'll be meshing up the entire volume. We can't mesh up to infinity, so if we have a radiation problem, we have to terminate, we have to stop our mesh somewhere, and when we stop our mesh, we have to do something different, because PDE techniques do not naturally handle a mesh that just stops. The mesh has to go everywhere. So we have to have special elements that we create along the boundary where we're going to terminate the mesh, called absorbing boundary elements. And those are going to create a little complexity for the problem. Also, we're going to have to locate those a certain distance away from the from where all the action's happening, otherwise, because they're not going to be perfectly absorbing. So we need to be aware that we need those things. We're going to generate a large matrix. Matter of fact, we're going to have every one of those mesh elements is going to have a few unknowns associated with it. And because we're meshing up the entire volume, we're going to have many more unknowns than we have for a surface integral technique. But the matrix is going to be very sparse. Most of the elements are going to be zero, like 97% or on that order. So if we use sparse matrix techniques, it's not as difficult to solve. A finite element method might have solved for 10,000 or 30,000 unknowns. And yet we can do that. We couldn't do a moment method with 10 or 30,000 unknowns because we couldn't handle a dense matrix with an order that large. Most of us couldn't. But a finite element method, you can because it's sparse. It's a sparse matrix. You only store the non-zero elements or as few of those zeros as you can get away with. And then we have techniques for solving sparse matrix equations that work faster for the order of the matrix than on dense matrices. So it's really not a big disadvantage, although the marketing people will use that. Somebody who sells a finite element code is going to say, oh, yeah, with our code, you can have 30,000 unknowns, and with their code, you can only have 1,000 unknowns. Well, it's not the same size as an unknown to solve that essentially the same size problem. Also, there are two types of finite element codes. I'll just say this briefly, scalar codes and vector codes. Without going into it, there's no reason to go with a scalar code ever. Pretty much, commercial codes now are pretty much vector codes for the most part. The problem with scalar codes, node-based codes, is that you end up putting the unknowns often right on interfaces where the field is discontinuous. You're trying to solve for a field at a place where the field is discontinuous, like if you had a conductor, or the corner of a conductor, and you try to solve for the electric field strength on the corner of a conductor. Well, it inside the conductor at zero and outside the conductor, it has some direction we don't even really know, and some amplitude that's certainly not zero, and we don't know what it is. So what number do we put in for that corner? It becomes very difficult to work with. What things are the finite element method codes good at? Well, actually, these are listed in the same order as the previous slide for moment method code, but you see, it's just the reverse. Complex source geometries, no problem for a finite element code. We can mesh down tightly around areas of high complexity, and then we can have a big coarse mesh as we get away from it. And that creates no numerical problems at all for a finite element code. So we can get as complex as we want. Dielectrics, it takes no more elements to model a dielectric than it does a conductor. Well, a perfect conductor doesn't require any elements because we can set the field equal. But it doesn't matter what type of material you have in general. The number of elements doesn't change. It doesn't matter what kind of a dielectric we have. Thin metal surfaces, again, no problem. If I've got a metal surface, my boundary condition in the finite element method is going to say the field goes to zero everywhere on that surface. And so it's going to go to zero. I don't have to worry about a cancellation of fields from distant sources at that surface. So it models thin metal surfaces very well. Tightly coupled electrically small conductors, in the case where I had a lot of intricate stuff going on over here and then big coarse things over here, no numerical problems because I don't model the interaction between distant things directly. The reason the matrix is sparse is because I'm modeling things that are next to each other. I do have to gradually build out. I can't have a lot of tight elements here and then suddenly jump to a big element. But I can have very fine meshing here and very coarse meshing here, and it creates no numerical problems. However, if I have a long resonant wire, like I had that printed circuit board with the long wire, with the surface integral technique, I was able to model that by just essentially segmenting the wire. But with a finite element method, I have to mesh the volume. And if the wire goes from here to the wall, that means my mesh has to go not only from here to the wall, but that same distance up and that same distance down and that same distance out and that same distance back. So to model something that's big in one direction, I end up having to create something that's big in three dimensions or three directions. And so it takes a lot of elements. If I wanted to model, I mentioned the half-wave dipole that I could model with 10 or 20 elements with a surface integral technique. With a finite element technique, it requires a lot of elements. It's hard to put a number on it, but it's a lot. I'm going to have to mesh down finely around the wire. I'm going to have to get a course. I'm going to have to go way up, way down, as well as out. And I have to go beyond the ends of the wire, too. Can't just go up to the ends of the wire. And then I'm going to have absorbing boundaries, which the unbounded geometry problem. Unbounded or absorbing elements for the finite element method really don't work all that well. They work okay, but you've got to get them pretty far away from where things are happening. And pretty far away often means a wavelength or a couple wavelengths away. And at low frequencies, that means can mean you're having to get pretty far away from the problem. So you're requiring a lot of elements. That can be a real disadvantage for the finite element method, is modeling unbounded problems, particularly if you have something that's long in one dimension. If you wanted to play around with finite element method, there's a code called QuickField, which used to be free, and now it's a commercial code, but they have a demo code, which is free, and even the commercial code is not very expensive. It's a 2D finite element code, but it's a good code for getting a feeling for what you can do with finite element modeling. Finite difference time domain. Used to be 10 years ago, there were people doing finite difference time domain modeling, but it wasn't really in the mainstream. It was more a curiosity. Now, all of a sudden, it's become much, much more popular. The reason is finite difference time domain codes in general, even for modeling relatively simple things, require a lot of elements, a lot of computer resources. And so 10 years ago when we didn't have very powerful computers, it wasn't as appealing an option. But with finite difference time domain, things scale better. With finite difference time domain, the more complex something gets, we're not solving a matrix. We're time stepping. We're gridding up all of space into cubes, and we're saying, okay, at time t equals zero, this was my boundary condition. I had a field right here. At time t equals zero, I haven't said an electric field right here. At time t equals 1/2, I calculate what the magnetic field would be as a result of that of the time varying electric field that I had. At a time t equals 1, I calculate the electric field that magnetic field created, and I sort of step in time and watch the fields propagate out through the mesh. That means I'm going to have to mesh up the entire volume as a PDE technique. And that means I am going to have absorbing boundaries, although the absorbing boundaries do work better for FDTD techniques than they do for finite element methods. It's not as big a limitation for FDTD. But I have no matrix. I don't create a big matrix and solve it. I time step through. So I do have to save the fields everywhere in my mesh, which means if I have a mesh, well, it means I have to save an awful lot of unknowns. But if I look at how that scales, if I double the size of the problem, I have to, if I double the number of unknowns, essentially, I'm going to a little bit more than double the number of calculations that I have to do, say on the order of, is it n squared? I'm not sure. Yeah. I'm going to have to increase it. But in a moment method calculation, if I double the number of unknowns, the matrix solution time is on the order of n cubed, so it takes about 8 times as long to run. And so even though FDTD problems in general require more computer resources for simple things, the more complex my geometry looks, the more unknowns I have, the better and better FDTD looks. The other thing is I'm solving things in the time domain. I'm going to get a time domain solution. If I want frequency domain information, I'm going to have to transform the time domain into the frequency domain. And that can be a disadvantage if you're looking for the response at one frequency, although if you're looking for the response over a wide band of frequencies, that can be an advantage because you do one calculation, transform it, and you've got all of the frequencies. That, actually, being a PDD technique, essentially the same things that a finite element code are good at. Complex source geometries, no problem, although with FDTD we can't vary the size of the mesh. There are some FDTD codes or FVDTD codes where we do have allow for variable size meshes, but they're not really widely used or very practical at this point. If you're going to use an FDTD code, you're going to want to have the same size mesh everywhere. So as long as you don't want to get too tiny with your source or tinier, because that means the detail of your mesh has to be as fine as the finest detail that you want to model in general. But in general, it doesn't matter how complex it looks for a given mesh size. Dielectrics are no problem. It doesn't require any more work, any more computer resource to model a dielectric than it does to model anything else. Thin metal surfaces, again, no problem. Tightly coupled electrically small conductors, no problem. Thin electrically long or resonant wires, now that's not looking so desirable again because we have to mesh up the entire volume. So if the wire goes from here to the wall, I still need to have a mesh that goes all the way up, all the way down. Unbounded geometries, I should probably change that. When I first created this, the absorbing boundary conditions weren't as good as they are now. It's really not. FDTD codes do a pretty good job of modeling unbounded geometries. I still do have to mesh up away from the source, though. If I have a source this long, I can't just mesh up and down this high. I've got to go at least up and down as high as the thing is long. But then I can put an absorbing boundary there, and it's going to work pretty well. Actually, just mention some of my colleagues from Apertures. From a box. And it works very well for something like that. I can put sources in there and set out the FDTD code. But the reason I mention it is because one of the students then modeled a box with a long wire attached to it, essentially a resonant, well, 0.2 lambda long wire on there as a function of frequency. And this is the kind of thing that I just said FDTD code is not good at, long, thin wires. And yet, the graduate students actually got very good results doing that modeling. So whenever I say something's not good at something, doesn't mean it can't be done. Just means that if that's the main priority, then that particular technique is not the best technique at that thing. In this particular case, if there were dielectrics inside that box, a moment method code would have had a difficult time modeling this. Or if the inside of the box was resonant, a moment method code would have had a difficult time modeling this, and FDTD would really be the only option, again, even though it did have the electrically long wires. By the way, they modeled long thin wires not by meshing down the mesh to the diameter of the wire, but generally by creating special elements that are meant to be an element with a wire inside. So it's a unique element with it where you define the wire radius. Okay, those are the three main techniques. There are several other numerical modeling techniques that you've probably run across. Maybe most among the most popular, transmission line matrix method. I didn't create a separate slide for it because essentially the advantages and disadvantages are very similar to finite difference time domain. It's really, instead of modeling things as E fields and H fields propagating, you model all of space as voltages and currents propagating out through inductances and capacitors, which are representing things are propagating essentially in transmission lines through space. For people with a circuits background, that's, I think, apparently more intuitive, and that's why they like the transmission line matrix method. I personally prefer the FDTD method. Essentially, though, they're very, very similar. It does require more storage, though, per node with the transmission line matrix method. And so that is one disadvantage. Generalized multipulse technique, that's an amazing technique. Every year at the Applied Computational Electromagnetic Society Symposium, these people show up from the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, and they've modeled just amazing things with the generalized multipole technique. It's essentially a surface integral technique, like moment method, only instead of the unknowns being currents on patches or wires, the unknowns are the fields due to multipole sources. And so when you want to model something, you place a bunch of multipole sources on it and run the code. And the trick is placing those multipole sources in the right place to get good results.
And Swiss people know where to put it.
That's right. And that's right. It's a very powerful technique. You can do great things with it, I'm convinced. But you have to, it's an art. And for that reason, I don't think it's ever going to really catch on and be used widely. Finite element time domain technique is dead. When I created this, people were talking about it, but no longer. Hybrid techniques. This is combining two techniques into one code where you use one technique where it is good and another technique on where it is good. Just an example and the moment method. So if you want to model something like a printed circuit board attached to a long wire, you can grid up the area on the printed circuit board and model that with the finite element method. At the same time, you're gridding the surface associated with the conductors and modeling those with the moment method, and then you're also solving equations on the boundary to make sure that the boundary conditions match at the boundary. You're doing all of this simultaneously to come to a solution. It combines the advantages of both techniques so that I don't have to worry about absorbing boundaries out here, or I don't have to worry about tightly coupled conductors in there. But I'm combining some of the disadvantages of both techniques too, because I get a large sparse matrix that's not really quite so sparse anymore. But for many types of problems, you're much better off combining two methods than you are using either one method. This is just another example. Inside of an enclosure, finite element methods works great inside enclosures. And moment method works great outside enclosures. And so if you can combine them, that's a good way to go. Expert system software, that's numerical modeling software. It works great. You can do when you find a problem that you're having, an EMC type problem, you can often use numerical modeling tools to help you figure out exactly what is going on. A lot of times you can't measure currents. Surface currents are very, very difficult to measure, and often in the process of trying to measure them, you end up changing them. But you can model them. So you can get an idea of what's going on from the model, whereas you couldn't get an idea, a clear idea of what was going on from the measurement. But as I mentioned before, they're not particularly useful for people who want to fix EMC problems, find and fix an EMC problem. Expert system software. We first got involved in expert system software when we were numerical modeling people. We were trying to market, I guess market's the right word, I don't know if it applies to engineering faculty, but market the idea of applying numerical modeling software to help with EMC problems. And quite often people would say, yeah, that's what we need. We need numerical modeling software. But in talking to them, that's not really what they needed at all. Matter of fact, we had a vice president from Motorola who came to visit us at UMR, came all the way to Rolla, Missouri to talk to us one time. And he said, I've got a great deal for you guys. He said, our company has a lot of EMC problems. And I've been talking with other executives at other companies, and they're having a lot of EMC problems. He said, I think I can get together a large group of companies to pool their resources and fund at a high level the development of numerical modeling software. About the board, because in general they're not going to know it. And our experience with Boeing and our experience with other companies that we work with in terms of software that they use, if it requires them to know too much, they're not going to use it. And they're never going to know everything they need to know about the board. So we have to work with what we've got. Cannot require the user to be an expert in anything, because you never know who might be using the code. And chances are they're not going to be an expert in the things that you might expect them to be. So expert system software has to look at the board and analyze it without knowing a lot of things about the board, perhaps. And it cannot ask the user a lot of questions. That was one thing Boeing really stressed to us. Said, if you ask the user questions, they're not going to use it. Because if they don't know the answer, they're not going to be able to run it. And even if they do know the answer, they're not going to put up with a lot of questions from a computer. If it's too much effort to run, they're not going to do it. I guess I mentioned before, and to some people, we have a consortium of companies that's working on expert system software development. Three of those companies are software companies, and they're actually writing software. One thing we learned in working with Boeing is we shouldn't be writing software. Not because we can't write software. We do a reasonable job, but first of all, we don't like to necessarily. The other thing is we don't support software. Universities that write software, they'll support it while they're being funded, but when the funding's gone, they can't continue to answer telephone calls and make updates. And so we knew with this particular project that we did not want to write the software. We got software companies involved that do that. And also that means that it works a lot better for us. We don't profit from the development of the software, and you could argue we shouldn't, but it sure makes things easier for us when we don't profit. Because then we can tell people what we really think about it, I guess. But what we're doing is developing algorithms, and the expert system software works in this way, essentially. This is sort of a very basic flowchart. But we read the board layout files. That's in the center. But that's not enough information to do anything really useful. We also need to know what the components are on the board, and we need to know things about the components. Because ultimately, we want to know what all the signals look like on all the traces. If we can't identify the components, we're never going to know that. So we need to read, this says EMC library file. That's really a component log. That file has to be maintained really by every company that uses the code. Because every company is going to use different components. They're going to use them in different ways. They're going to want different information in that file. And that's going to have to be updated. So this expert system is not buy the shrink wrap thing and it solves your problems. It's something that's maintained by the EMC people at a particular company and used by the people, board layout people, circuit designers, or even EMC engineers. The other thing is this personality file. We learned we have a wide number of companies that we're working with. The automotive boards do not look anything like the telecommunications boards or the high-speed workstation boards. If I took any engineer out of here who was working for a telecommunications company and plopped you down at Chrysler, you'd be shocked at the designs. You'd think, oh boy, this is never going to work, and yet it does work. But the rules are different. Things are different. And so any expert system is going to have its own personality, and that personality is going to have to exist somewhere. It exists in the personality file. Personality file does a couple of things. It determines some things about how the algorithms run later on. It also recognizes certain circuits that that a particular company might use. This group of components should all be connected in this way. That type of information is in the personality file. We take all of that and we do something called net classification. That's really an expert system in itself. That looks at all the components and in a very intelligent way guesses at what all the signals look like everywhere on the board. And that's really what an EMC engineer generally does. Oh, this is a clock trace. I know it because it goes into the clock input, or it comes out of this, I see this oscillator and this clock driver, and here's a trace that comes out of the clock driver. I'll bet that's a clock trace. The expert system code does this the same type of analysis. It looks at what kinds of components different traces are attached to. It traces through components to see, okay, this trace was driven by this component, which was driven by this component, and figures out for every trace, essentially rise time, the frequencies that are there. Is it a digital or analog signal? Is it narrow band or is it digital? All that, is it data? Is it clock? Or is this just a reset line? All that information is figured out by the net classification algorithm, which is one little inconspicuous block in this flowchart, although it's actually an expert system in itself. And right now it accounts for about a little more than half of all the code that's been developed. It's a fairly complex process. After it does that, it identifies problems with the layout. Generally, when it identifies the problem, it either means somebody made a mistake in laying it out, or net classification made a mistake in interpreting the layout. Either way, we want to report that back and allow the user to correct anything that's not quite right. And I say allow. We never require anything. We allow the user to make changes, but we never require it. Prompt user for additional system information. Another block that's missing is if simulations have been done for a particular design, that simulation data can be imported and essentially override what net classification decided the signal looked like. At that point, we have all of the signals on all of the nets and all of the component information. Then we can drop down and actually over here, these are the algorithms that are estimating radiated EMI, and they're doing that the way an EMC engineer would, looking for sources, looking for antennas, looking for the coupling paths between the sources and antennas. We have voltage-driven sources, current-driven sources. Those are ways that differential mode signals become common mode currents, which result in radiated EMI generally below 500 megahertz. That differential mode radiation, that's the algorithm you were mentioning before, radiation directly from the trace. We calculate that, but we only did it because the customer said, well, we need to calculate that. That's never the problem. But we just calculate it for completeness. It doesn't take long. On the other side are susceptibility type algorithms. We look for crosstalk between traces. Here's an analog trace, and we have a noise margin of this much. Here's a digital trace nearby. What's the noise coupled to the sensitive trace from that digital trace? Is it more than the noise margin? If so, that's a problem. And we flag that. We don't actually predict the results of any tests, any susceptibility tests. We just flag what we think are potential susceptibility problems. As hard to repeat as radiated EMI measurements are, the susceptibility tests are crazy. People do them in very different ways. We just point to problems rather than trying to predict the results of a test. In the middle of the design rules, actually these arrows are no longer here. The way we originally envisioned this thing, the design rules would also contribute to our estimate. As it's turned out, We never use design rules to contribute to the estimate. Anything that we can point to, we can calculate an effect that it has. But we do use the design rules to find problems. A lot of times somebody will make one mistake and it will cause 100 sources to drive 100 antennas and the person will be overwhelmed with problems. And a good example of that would be if you build a board and you put a connector on one side and you put a connector on the opposite side. Well, every circuit on that entire board now is driving one connector relative to the other. And it's actually very difficult when you design a board that way to make it pass. Because you've created a problem for yourself that's very hard to overcome. You essentially, at the very least, require some kind of shielding in there if you've got any kind of high-speed circuitry at all. And you could easily correct that by putting both connectors on the same side or getting one connector on one edge and another connector near it so that you don't get the high-speed circuitry in between the two connectors. But if somebody does do that, the expert system is going to go through and say, okay, this source drove this connector relative to this connector. This source drove this connector relative to this connector. And it's going to find a lot of problems on the board. The whole purpose of the design rule is to say, hey, you violated a design rule, and that is you put connectors on opposite ends of the board. Try fixing the design rule violation, then rerun the code and see what you get. We can estimate the radiated field. Of course, we don't know anything about the enclosure. We don't know anything about the cables attached. But as it turns out, we can do a pretty good job because of this wording in the FCC and CISPR specs that says arrange your cables so that you tend to maximize emissions. If you really did a careful job, you cause something to go resonant. We know what all the sources look like. We know what all the potential antennas are. We just say, okay, this antenna went resonant. Because if they were doing a careful job, it did go resonant. When it went resonant, its radiation resistance was approximately 100 ohms. So we say, okay, we know how much power is radiated. And it's essentially an omnidirectional source, at least below 500 megahertz. We can say we're essentially omnidirectional, so we know what the field strength is any given distance away. So it's really not as difficult a problem as you might think, although we're going to overestimate in general because when you arrange your cables and you tend to maximize emissions, you're focusing on one frequency. So you tend to maximize them at one frequency, whereas the code is going to tend to maximize them at all frequencies, which theoretically you could do if you were careful enough with your measurement. But at least it's going to give you a good indication of how hard you might, at any one frequency, drive the cables with your particular design. We display the graph of radiated EMI as a function of frequency because that's what everybody wants to see. That's one result they can relate to. But of course, it's an estimate. It's like a human EMC engineer's estimate. You shouldn't expect your actual radiated result to look that way. But it gives you a very good indication that you have a big problem or not a big problem. You can then go in and click on any frequency where you have a problem, and it can list the sources and the antennas that created that problem or contributed to that problem and how much they contributed. So we identify those critical circuits or structures on the board, and then we can suggest design changes. If you have a clock line coupling to an I/O line, we can suggest that you move them apart. Simple things like that. Software is very good at doing crosstalk calculations, tracing signals. I mentioned on the 14-layer board, you got the clock trace next to the I/O trace. Computer finds that right away. Human EMC engineer takes a long time. It's not bothered by part numbers. It knows instantly everything about the board. So in many ways, it can do many things better than a human EMC engineer can. They're not willing to tell a computer about their board. So if there's not something that's immediately obvious, if there's not something that can be figured out from the component information and the trace information, it's unlikely that most humans are going to spend the time with the computer to tell it, at least until they've established some sort of relationship with the computer and they are realizing it's giving them valuable results. I'll just stop there and summarize sort of everything now. Talk about numerical modeling tools. Numerical modeling tools are great. I'm a big fan of numerical modeling tools. A lot of people are buying them for the wrong reasons and end up being incredibly disappointed with them. They're very good at what they do at, and they're very useful for EMC engineers. Generally, if you could use something like an expert system to say, okay, here's the problem.